Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last year, it was drought, a big one. This year, fire and flood. Farming has come with challenges, always. Climate change makes them bigger. My guest today looks in from the dry side at thousands of years of human learning and the challenge now, this hour on Point, farming into climate change. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you out there doing it? What's your report from your field, your pasture, your garden, your harvest? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Tucson, Arizona, is agricultural ecologist and ethnobotanist Gary Paul Navin. Navin is a celebrated food and farming activist who farms himself on the hot, dry Mexican border. He's a research scientist at the Southwest Center at the University of Arizona, author of the new book, Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers on Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. He joins us today from NPR member station KUAZ in Tucson. Gary Paul Navin, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Greetings. I'm grateful to be here.
We've got all kinds of weather patterns around this country. You know, we know that there's been a big drought going on in a lot of North America. We certainly saw a lot of it all over the place last year. I mean, this year, right now, we've got flooding in some places. And in the Midwest, we have projections of maybe record harvests. Well, look at all that. Where's your focus in warning? You know, the headline on your recent essay, Gary, was Our Coming Food Crisis. Where are you looking?
We are facing greater climate uncertainty than ever before. It may not be hotter, drier everywhere. Each region will face more climatic extremes, but we can't predict when and how severe. And catastrophic freezes and floods may be as common in some regions as the droughts have been in others. So we need to learn how to adapt to that uncertainty and learn from the farmers and ranchers who are already doing it.
Let's focus on the western states for a moment. We're going to pull it back to the Midwest later in the hour, but let's look at these. You've been writing about 17 western states, 40% of the net farm income for the country comes out of there. And we know, we've heard before this recent sort of wave of rain came through, we had all those incredible temperatures in June, July. What are you seeing in those 17 western states that you first focused on here, Gary?
Well, it wasn't merely that Furnace Creek in Death Valley approached 130 degrees. It was that at least nine states had extended periods of triple-digit heat waves when their crops were in flower and fruit, the most vulnerable time for crop production in terms of the outcomes of fruit quality and quantity. And so it was a tough time to hit it. We're used to heat waves coming in August and September, but this was quite early. We may expect more. It's hard to predict. But the point is that these may come more frequently if some climate models are correct, that we should anticipate 7 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit increases over the next century.
And you're talking about in these states, of course, cattle and sheep, we think of that. We get out to California, you've got salad greens and dry beans and onions and melons and hops and barley and wheat and citrus, and then really vulnerable crops, apricots and zucchini, Idaho with their potato crops. Where do you see or fear the biggest damage? And what are you seeing in terms of adaptation? I mean, that's quite a hopper full of different kinds of crops we just described there. You can hardly imagine this country's diet without them. What are you suggesting?
Well, we actually need that diversity, and we may need more diversity of varieties within each of those crops over the next 50 years because some varieties are more vulnerable than others to one extreme or the next. So I think investing at this point in time in creating an even greater diversity of crops in the landscape is going to be one of our most important buffers against this uncertainty.
But like what? When you get into that list of what we currently depend on these states for, you know, salad and beans and melons and hops and barley and wheat and, you know, cattle. I mean, that's a big part of the American diet. What are you suggesting? Different varieties of those species or different foods entirely, different crops?
Well, in part, I think we're going to see three shifts, that we're going to see more drought and heat tolerant varieties of dry beans, for example, out in the Idaho, Wyoming, and Colorado landscape. Right now, it's largely pinto beans and two or three other varieties, mm-hmm. and they don't have much heat tolerance compared to some tepary beans and lima beans and cowpeas and field peas. So we're going to see a shift in varieties, particularly with fruit trees and grapes. But we're also going to see shifts in the seasonality of when crops are planted. It's going to be a longer growing season, but much more irrigation needed. So we're going to have to look at water use efficiency of crops as well. And I think we're going to see farmers really investing, as the best farmers have already done, in building up the moisture-holding capacity and ways to buffer their crops from hot, dry winds by hedgerows and windbreaks and even solar panel covers over row crops.
New varieties, that may mean different different foods on the plate at some point, or maybe just different versions of what we're accustomed to. You want to help protect the soil in a hotter, drier time. You mentioned hedgerows. I mean, that used to be the way things were over the big parts of this country's breadbasket. And then we came to, you know, just a side-to-side farming. All the hedgerows were pulled out at a certain point.
That's right, Tom. Our grandparents never thought of a farm as simply fields from fence line to fence line. Mm-hmm. There were always green belts, windbreaks, hedgerows, green strips between fields, and those buffer us not only from heat and drought but from floods and from winds. And so it's real important to build that diversity back into our farmscapes as a buffer against all this uncertainty.
You're talking about, for the soil itself, what may become a requirement of cooperation between farm and city. What's the city potential connection to maintaining soil?
Well, it's surprising to think that we waste most of the green materials that could be composted and put back on our fields today, that there's a tremendous amount of compostable green waste in cities that is still going into landfills and generating methane, one of the greenhouse gases, when we really need to compost that with wood materials from forest thinning and put that back in the soil to increase the moisture-holding capacity of our soils. That can buffer us both from droughts and floods, but we need this urban-rural cooperation. In fact, farmers and the greenhouse gas emissions on farms are only one-fifth of our carbon footprint, if you care to use that term. The cities have to be part of the solution, not the problems, and we can't think that farmers should be regulated and none of the rest of us should change our behavior. I think we can do this without regulating farmers. I think we need cooperation between eaters and farmers to get this work done.
I mean, traditionally, farmers plowed a lot of that back into the soil. I spent half my youth on a manure spreader, it seemed like, sometimes, and a lot more besides. What is it that you want from the cities? What would they have to be doing? You're talking about like Europe, where all the sort of food waste goes into a separate container and that ends up into compost and ends up back on field somewhere?
That's not just in Europe, and it was a good practice decades ago, and cities like Seattle and Portland and Berkeley are already charging fees to have people separate that, and then that green waste is composted and goes back into both urban agriculture and rural agriculture. This is a key point, that the common sense practices that you're talking about that were done up until about 50 years ago have been abandoned in parts of this country. They still make sense, and they're not that costly. In fact, they may save us billions of dollars in crop insurance payments if we get ahead of the ball game and begin this kind of adaptation to climate uncertainty.
You say we're going to have to change our ways with water as well. In what way?
Well, obviously, hotter temperatures, particularly in the summer, mean more irrigation, and longer growing seasons also imply one or two more irrigations. And 3 years ago, we had 80% of the reservoirs dry in New Mexico. The Lake Mead was at its lowest level since it was built 90-some years ago. And so we need to conserve that water well, make sure that our irrigation delivery systems are more efficient like those in Israel and Palestine. And we need to fit our crops to the water availability rather than simply trying to remake the environment to fit a particular crop. So we're going to see some shifts in better matching of soils and microclimates with particular crops to get higher water use efficiencies.
Do you sense Americans taking this on board, Gary, your message? I mean, this country has been such a mighty agricultural producer for so long. Do people still feel like, oh, come on, let's just do it the way we do it? We really pump out the food here.
You know, we do pump out the food, but we've been importing more food the last few years than we export. We've had $11 billion of crop insurance payments the last year because of crop failures. And I think the most innovative farmers and ranchers are already making these changes. And we need to foster that, lower the hurdles to them doing it, and make sure that their neighbors understand these innovations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hotter, drier, sometimes colder, wetter extremes, and American agriculture in a time of climate change. My guest is Gary Paul Nabum. He's author of Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers on Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. You can read a terrific excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We're going to be joined in a few minutes by an agronomy expert from Iowa, right in the middle of Midwestern breadbasket farming. Gary Nabum joins us from NPR member station KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona. Gary, you've done some of your own farming down there near the Mexican border. What do you farm?
I have about 70 varieties of fruits and nut trees, and they are from the Spanish mission era, largely the introductions that came to Mexico and the United States from Morocco, Spain, and the Canary Islands that are already quite drought-adapted. They also don't require many chill hours, a key factor as we get milder winters. We haven't had mild winters here the last 2 years in Arizona. We've had catastrophic freezes that have killed about $5,000 of my tree saplings, but my orchard is recovering. I harvest rainwater off the surrounding slopes and roofs. I use drought-adapted annual crops underneath the trees when the summer rains begin. And I try to build up the soil moisture-holding capacity that I have in my orchard with composted materials from local sources. So it's a great challenge, but it's great fun.
I know you work with the group, co-founder of Native Seeds Search, this nonprofit to conserve and document and distribute agricultural seeds and wild relatives. But you've got listeners very keyed in on how we've narrowed the range of seeds that we use. Kath writes to us here, says, if you consider that seeds for big crops, she lists, once had hundreds of varieties that adjusted to conditions, added to heat and drought and poor soil condition, we've compounded the problem, she says. And another, even skeptical that Americans will respond to the climate change challenge, George says, you know, Americans don't agree the climate is changing. And if they do, it will only encourage the corporate farmers like Monsanto working in the fields to, this listener says further, bastardize life as we know it. Won't be worth eating anyway. You know, not seed varieties necessarily, but modification.
Well, Those comments are very perceptive. I think that we all know that diversity is a buffer against unknown conditions. Getting more of that diversity on the landscape is something that I see farmers involved in the community-supported agriculture movement doing, and they've done a wonderful job of it, increasing the number of varieties available to CSA or community-supported ag members many-fold over the last 15 years, 3,500 crop varieties in people's weekly baskets that we didn't have in our fields or on our plates 15 years ago. So America's agriculture is rediversifying. We know that climate-friendly GMOs are being produced by certain companies, but they cost $15 million to $150 million to produce, and we could screen the many heirloom and heritage breeds and seeds that we have in our USDA collections, evaluate them for their tolerance to heat, drought, flood, and other conditions, and with the same amount of money, get tens of thousands of varieties back into the foodscape rather than one climate-friendly GMO.
Do you think we're going to need to do that, and how soon?
I think we're going to need to do that within the next 10 years, and I think farmers are up for it. The 20,000 farmers listed on localharvest.org that are direct marketing their food are getting value added by telling the stories of these drought and heat and climate adapted varieties. So I think there's growing incentives for our farmers to diversify, and some may feel like they're being dragged along. But again, my own opinion is we don't need to have regulations enforce this. We need to give people positive incentives. And I think farmers themselves are doing some great innovations. We don't have to cajole them into it. They're seeing the writing on the wall perhaps more immediately than most of the American public is.
They're closer to it than anybody. Gary Davin, please stand by in Tucson. We've got listeners all over the country eager to speak with you. Ed in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Ed, you're on the air with Gary Nabin in Tucson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really, everything you said, Gary, is awesome, and I'm so glad you're on the air. I would also want to argue that desert farming shouldn't be our goal. I mean, like, it didn't really work out very well for the Anasazi or the people that used to live in the Sahara or Iraq. It works, but until it really doesn't work suddenly. But I think also we're missing the whole point of why this is happening, and it's a bigger issue than maybe we want to think about, but nobody seems to be thinking about it. The whole Midwest used to be 6 feet of topsoil and sod covered in lush prairie. And there used to be mature forest covering everything in this country that wasn't prairie or desert, and the desert used to be a lot smaller. And I would imagine, or I know this is true, the transpiration of water and oxygen from the biomass that isn't there anymore is what gave us the rainfall that we formerly enjoyed. It really doesn't matter at all. Like, if you look at the IUPAC models, which are a little flawed, but they still give a really good idea, it doesn't matter if the whole Earth cuts all of its emissions if we don't rebuild the carbon sink that gave us the climate we used to have. I was thinking if we went to a straight-up permaculture model for almost the entire country, we could have the rain and the productive capacity back that we used to.
And what do you mean by that, Ed, that permaculture model? What does that mean?
Yeah, so permaculture is basically adapting your farming to what nature would be in the area you're in if you just let the fields lie fallow. So if you would normally have a forest, you have essentially a forest garden that is where you try to get food and whatever else you want out of whatever can grow in the ground out of that forest from every story of the forest. So, you know,
I mean, but isn't that almost unimaginable? I mean, I take your point, but I mean, those virgin prairies in the Midwest are long gone. Those forests, vast sycamore forests, I'm thinking southern Illinois and Indiana, gone, gone, gone. You're talking about going back to the year 1690?
That would be awesome. It would take a long time, but we can get pretty close to that in just 20 years. And I know it would take a lot of labor, but last time I checked, we got like 100 million able-bodied workers who aren't doing anything in this country right now or are very underemployed, and we already subsidized them, and we subsidized farming. If you put that money together, we should be able to do this no problem.
I mean, Ed, we hear the depth of your focus on this, and it's really terrific. I mean, Gary, it can sound extreme. On the other hand, we are moving up against some extreme conditions here. How do you respond to Ed's call?
Well, thank you, Ed. I appreciate your insights, and I think you're right on that we have to look at the root causes. And the two elements of permaculture that I endorse are the perennialization of our crops, a stepwise shift back to more and more perennial crops that store more carbon in the soil.
Like what?
For instance, switching to fruit trees, using perennial grains in pastures rather than annual grains or legumes. We also have great perennial legumes, and those.
What's a perennial grain? Just to help us out here.
Well, there's some gamma grasses related to corn that make terrific pasture grasses that are already being used in the Southeast and the Southern Midwest, and they are perennial tall grass prairie-like grasses that have been selected for pasture production. Many legumes can be grown as perennials, and these can store 7 to 9 times as much carbon in the soil as annual crops that also need a lot more tillage.
Can you feed 350 Americans on that kind of a diet, or 9 billion people in the world?
Those pastures the perennial pastures are as productive as the annual pastures for the same amount of water. So it's really resource conservation without much reduction in yield. In fact, it may increase the yield in some soil. So one of the things that the permaculturalists like Ed talk about are stacking functions, so that we're selecting crops that are putting more carbon in the soil, rebuilding that soil while they're sustaining productivity with less irrigation. And it may seem like getting squeezing the turnip for all it has, but the truth is that we can redesign our pasture systems very quickly to be perennial. We can do more orchard crop plantings that store carbon in the soil, and we can harvest rainwater in many of these areas, the mountain landscapes and the desert landscapes. Water harvesting is underutilized, and that's a key point of the permaculture studies that Ed is referring to.
Ed, I appreciate your call in Virginia. Let's get another here from Cookeville, Tennessee. Shannon. Shannon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Well, my question for Mr. Nobin is how to decide what varieties to plant, say a field corn, which is something I've been growing for years. And we alternate here in the Southeast between extreme years with a lot of drought and heat, alternating with cool, wet years. So, like, if I choose, and I do grow the heirloom varieties, and I save the seeds and all that, and if I start growing a drought-resistant type, and it's doing fine during the hot, dry years, if I plant it in the, like this year, it was wet and cool, it doesn't do well. So, I mean, I'm trying to diversify, but sometimes it's a little impractical. I mean, should I have, how many different varieties should I grow to deal with this extreme changes?
And how do you know in advance? How does Shannon deal with the yo-yo pattern there, Gary?
Yeah. Well, I sympathize with you, Shannon. I'm not a prophet or a forecaster, but I can say that when I planted 4 or 5 different varieties and staggered my planting dates, I have a higher probability of getting good yields out of 2 or 3 of those corn varieties or bean varieties than I would if I had a single planting date and a single variety. So the whole idea of intercropping and polycultures and mixed lines of a single crop like beans, planting 5 or 6 kind of beans together that can all be used as dry beans is one strategy. It may not fit for your land, but I completely sympathize with you that we feel like we're on a yo-yo. That's what we feel like with catastrophic freezes in the winter and catastrophic heat waves in the summer. So I'm totally with you. This is not easy to figure out in just 1 year, but diversity is part of the solution.
But that sounds like a, I don't know, like a financial portfolio where you want to have a bunch of different things going on. So no one move in the environment really takes you out. But can you farm that way? Were you going to plant a whole bunch of different beans, hoping one of them will grow this year?
It's the world's oldest bet hedging strategy. And yes, farmers have done that and continue to do it around the world. We're one of the few places that has such a large proportion of our farmscape in monocultures. And that speaks to our vulnerability. Again, it adds additional challenges, but farmers are inherently problem solvers. I don't think this is beyond their intelligence or technical capacity.
Gene Nabin, please stand by in Tucson. I want to welcome into our conversation from Ames, Iowa, Eugene Tuckley, professor of agronomy and geological and atmospheric sciences at Iowa State University's College of Agriculture, director of the school's climate science program. Gene Tuckley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
We did a show just about this time last year on drought and heat, and it was really, really raking people over the coals, farmers in particular. This year we're reading about a lot of water out there. Gary's been focused in particular on western states, but what about when you get into Iowa, and what do you see in terms of climate change, variation, how farmers are adapting?
We're seeing bigger changes both in with regard to too much water and too little water. Our extremes in the past 40 years have included both of these, primarily on too much water and a change in the seasonality where we're getting more of this in the spring and early summer. So it's caused farmers real challenges in getting crops in the ground and maintaining resistance to pests and pathogens that come from a higher rainfall environment.
And how are sort of breadbasket farmers there adapting to it? Is it still within our fence row industrial farming model? Are they beginning to pick up the kind of things Gary's talking about, or still within the industrial farming sort of model that's come to be so dominant in this country?
Well, farmers adapt to everything. They always have, and climate change is just another of many changes that they've had to adapt to. But this one is becoming more severe, and the adaptation strategies they use they've been able to cope with these changes to a certain extent, but they're getting more severe. We have a longer growing season, which enables longer season hybrids, which they are planting, mm-hmm. but we have wetter springs, which mean that it's harder to get those crops in the ground. They adapt by buying larger machinery so they can plant in smaller windows between rain events. They are planting higher densities of crops because of these additional rainfall, and so they're taking advantage of that and experiencing higher yields. So it's a plus and minus, but the minus side seems to be growing.
Gary, when you hear that kind of response to the Iowa manifestation of climate change, does it sound like it's on the beam that you're encouraging or not?
Well, I was just in Dr. Tuckley's state, and I completely agree with his diagnosis there. The farmers in eastern Iowa said that it's the latest they've ever planted corn, and some parts of their fields were just too wet to get their heavy machinery into. Other fields, upland fields, look great because that additional moisture was welcome and the planting densities were high, as he said. So I completely agree with his very balanced diagnosis that farmers are adapting as they always have, but we're bumping up against some conditions like new diseases and weeds because of these changing conditions that farmers now have additional challenges other than just climate extremes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hotter, drier, colder, wetter extremes and American agriculture in a time of climate change. Gary Nabum is with us from Tucson, Arizona, author of Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers on Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. Eugene Jean Tockley is with us from Ames, Iowa. He's at the Iowa State University's College of Agriculture, director of the school's Climate Science Program. Gene, Gary, interesting comments from people here. I mean, some people with really small operations. Emily writes into us, and she's got just a bit going on. She says, my eggplant is very happy this year. So are my peppers and tomatoes, everything in the nightshade family. Everything in the squash family, she writes, on the other hand, is at best struggling or toast already. I might give up on squash next year. I mean, even small planters, you know, think very carefully. And here's another. This is David from Lowell, kind of in our backyard here in Massachusetts. Is in our garden, the growing season, late frost was almost 3 weeks early this year. Usually last frost around Memorial Day. This year it was in the beginning of May. USDA says we're a 6A zone on the map, but in practice we're 6B now, maybe 7A. I mean, Gene Tockley, what about the fundamental growing conditions changing in different parts of the country? Do you see that in your region, Gene?
Yes, this is occurrence all over the mid latitudes, where our growing seasons are shifting northward, and this affects particularly tree crops, and so we're seeing trees in Iowa that may have not grown there very well in the past, but now are thriving. And so it applies both to perennials and, as indicated, our growing season here starts earlier too. So farmers are planting about 2 to 3 weeks earlier than they did 40 years ago.
Let's say climate change moves growing zones. On balance, does that equal out after, I don't know, how much dislocation does it equal out to comparable food production? Is that all right? If it shifts, do we somehow get stuck out on a limb, Gene?
We looked at that in a recent paper, looked at commodity crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, and rice. And that's a fortunate thing about the U.S. is with the early part of climate change, we're seeing a shift northward in many of the growing regions, and so regions in the southern part that are lost to production are being compensated for by expanded growing regions on the north.
Let's go to Michael in Maribel, Wisconsin. Michael, thanks for calling.
Yes. My wife and I farm in outside of Green Bay, and we have raised Holstein steers. We cash crop mostly.
Yeah.
The conversation, there's definitely global warming going on. The environment is changing for a number of reasons that we can see. The conversation, though, has focused only on dealing with environmental issues. There's no focus in the discussion that you've had so far, on the economics of farming. We have to make a living in farming. And if we're going to make a living in farming, we need to be able to earn at least an optimum, if not a maximum amount of income on the land that we have. And unless there is some realistic proposals, farmers are not going to change in the ways that have been suggested, given the amount of land that you have here.
I was trying to get at that a little bit, Michael, when I asked about dislocation. I mean, we can talk about growing regions changing and moving and seasons changing, and you know, but there you are. You're on your farm. You have to deal with what's right in front of you. When you hear Gary Nabin talk about we could do this or that, do those look like accessible options to you as an operating farmer?
They're not accessible from the standpoint of the amount of land that we run. For smaller farms, it is okay. For niche farming, it is fine. But you are not going to put millions of acres into fruit crops. You are not going to put tens of millions of acres into prairie. And there are other issues that are at stake here that also need to be addressed, such as the oligopolistic control of our agricultural markets.
And what about in your operation right there, raising Holsteins? You've got alfalfa and cattle. Are you seeing an impact of climate change, Michael?
Well, I'm definitely seeing an impact of climate change. I mean, the gentleman from Iowa State. Last year, we were exceptional. We were in a pocket that had just the right amount of rain. I had my best year ever last year in grain farming.
Yeah.
this year, we are 3 to 4 weeks behind in our planting. And while the volume of crops that were planted may be large, the yields are dropping this year simply because we had too much moisture and it was too cold very early in our planting season. We're seeing the effect there. Something else that is not being addressed is people are eating less meat. So, I mean, I'm not raising Holstein steers the past year and a half.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are some of the issues, the market issues that need to be addressed in this to make this realistic.
Michael, please stick with us for a second here. Gary, you're listening in Tucson. And, you know, Michael says, well, that's all great to talk about going to fruit trees and, you know, changing over to prairie, but it's not going to happen on the scale that may be required. And how does a farmer like him stay in business and, you know, feed the family while those changes are contemplated or we attempt to engage with them, Gary?
Well, I'm sympathetic with Michael. I don't think he said anything that is out of proportion, that we're seeing a lot of these innovations in small and medium-sized farms, and some of these innovations are indeed scale-dependent, as he is saying. I see people with his kind of acreage doing more direct marketing and value-added production. So instead of just selling milk, they're selling artisanal cheeses or the milk to produce them for higher value. And,
but he says you're not going to get these changes on the scale that you imply, Gary. That just won't happen.
Well, I think we've seen that scale expand in Organic Valley in Wisconsin that is bringing returns to farmers. That may not work for every farmer, but some of these direct marketing value-added product strategies can help farmers of varying scales. Nevertheless, I think his criticism is valid. I think he's making a key point in our economic policies affect this, whether we're subsidizing ethanol or whether we're subsidizing farmers to deal with some of the economic issues that he's talking about on his particular farm. I think we need to redress the balance of what we're subsidizing. I don't think subsidies to farmers are bad. I just want it to go to farmers like Michael who are struggling for reasons aside from their own intelligence and hard work.
Yeah, Gene, I don't know if Michael and his wife are going to go to artisanal cheeses. Maybe they will, but you hear him wrestling with the idea of the adaptation that may be required at the scale that he sees in American agriculture. And we all know, you know very well that it's there. I mean, how do you adapt at scale and make a living and keep everything rolling, Gene?
Well, we talk about three levels of adaptation. We talk about resistance, where you simply, no matter what comes, I'm just going to do what I did before.
Yep.
We talk about resilience, where you can gracefully recover from an annual or an occasional extreme. So we build in resilience into what we're doing. And diversity, for instance, as Gary has pointed out and as Michael mentioned, is certainly a major part of resilience. And the final is transformation, where it just becomes impossible to continue doing what we're doing. And we're seeing this in some places in Kansas that just have to give up on irrigated agriculture because even with the water that they have, it's impossible to raise irrigated corn. So we have to, and all adaptation is very local. And so Gary's correct that we need to we understand the local climate and how it's changing, and then look at what adaptation strategies we can adopt to build in resilience to our operations.
Farmer Michael in Maribel, outside of Green Bay, do you see your operation having enough, resilience and transformative capacity to stay at it on your land into another generation or two?
Well, I will stay at mine because I have virtually no debt. But most farmers, and mind you, there are 70,000 farmers in the state of Wisconsin. 11,000 are dairy farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Of those dairy, I mean, you talk about Organic Valley. I think Organic Valley is very good. It's a niche market. That's probably less than 2% of your dairy farms. So you know, I can survive, but some of my neighbors will not. And what happens in this process is you increasingly have mega farming resulting, and the small and medium-sized farmers are getting pushed out. Those who shift to niche markets like your CSAs, et cetera, they have expansion possibilities, but the expansion possibilities are limited by locality as well as scale. So, you know, I can see expansion occurring, but it's not going to occur for realistically probably more than 5% of farmers.
You make great points, Michael, and I'm very grateful for your call. Gene and Gary, I want to pick up this issue of mega farming. Gene, you're in the heart of mega farming country there. Are big farms more or less open to adaptation? And what about, I mean, how do you even get to the kind of idea Gary's putting out here of more smaller farmers all adapting in more diverse ways? Does that play in your part of the world, Gene?
Adaptation is becoming expensive, and so large operations with prices being quite high have been able to adapt by putting in more drainage tile, to subsurface drainage tile to get rid of the excess rain. They've been buying larger machinery and planting more crops in a shorter period of time, working day and night because they have machinery that's adapted to that. But there is a limit to, and even with, as we saw last year, the yields were down in Iowa because of the drought. And this year, as Gary pointed out, we just weren't able to get the crops in. So even with large inputs, financial inputs, some aspects of climate change that we're seeing just we can't adapt with the current technology. So diversity going to – we have two crops, corn and soybeans, but there's a lot of research at Iowa State and elsewhere on diversifying the landscape, as Gary pointed out, more crop rotation, use of grass waterways, and introducing other kinds of diversity into the landscape.
Gary Navin in Tucson, our caller outside Green Bay, says, you know, look at the sort of oligopoly dynamics of American agriculture, mega farming. And Gene says so far they've been able to use the capital available to them to adapt. But over time, there may be limits to that, Gary. And when we get there, how does a big farming, you know, huge-scale farming like we have in this country, how does it respond to climate change? It's not going to suddenly turn into a million little farmers, is it?
No, I'm not opposed to medium or large-scale farming. I think each of these scales is going to have to find its own balance of these factors, and there's challenges for each. And I really respect what Michael, the farmer, was saying and what Gene as a researcher is saying. There are bumps, and it's not just technological solutions that are going to get us out of this. With new pests and diseases, it's not just simply managing water or soil. We have a lot of challenges to face with shifting climates. And the answers for a large-scale farmer, a medium-scale farmer, and a small-scale farmer are going to be very different. But I'm excited when I go to Iowa to see what practical farmers of Iowa that varies in scale in terms of the operations of those farmers are doing from one side of the state to the other with pasture-fed pork and a variety of other innovations that didn't exist when I went to school in Iowa in the 1970s. I'm heartened to see the kinds of innovations happening even in a big ag state like Iowa with the Leopold Institute at Dr. Tockley's Iowa State University. I think there's real new solutions coming from the researcher-farmer collaborations that we see in a state like Iowa.
Well, there will need to be with challenges coming from all kinds of angles. I want to get one more angle on this from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Peter's calling. Hi, Peter. Our time is short, but tell us your situation.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on today. I'm a tough scout at the apple industry in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And for the last decade, our growers have been replanting trees into higher density plantings on trellis systems, switching to irrigated trees, But the big thing the last few years is increased frequency of hail events, which can take out an entire crop. You can go through an entire season and right at the end of August get a hail event that takes you out. So we're having more and more of our larger wholesale growers installing hail netting over new plantings going in. But, you know, a lot of our smaller growers that are offering a UTIC experience, you know, don't want to offer that to the consumer that comes out to the farm to pick fruit for an afternoon.
Peter, we're right up against it, but let me just pick that because it's so interesting. A crop advisor on apples there, they're getting more and more hail. I don't know if it's climate change related, so they're spending money now, the big apple folks there, on hail netting. I mean, Gary, the number of costs that come along with dealing with climate change, if that's what all that hail is about, are kind of overwhelming sometimes, Gary.
I agree, and because I've had the same threat to my own orchard, I'm completely sympathetic, and that's why we have to be open, alert to all kinds of challenges now. It's not the same as it was 20 years ago, and the new normal is already here.
We're just scratching the surface today, but it is fascinating to think and talk through what this is going to mean for American agriculture, American society, the shape of our agricultural economy, and ultimately for what we eat. I'm so grateful to the two of you for helping us do it. Gene Tockley in Ames, Iowa at Iowa State University. Gene, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you for having me.
And Gary Paul Nobin, author of Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, joining us from Tucson. Gary, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
Tomorrow in this hour, we're going to talk about family reunions. It's the season. What about those extended family get-togethers? Are they still out there? What's their significance? Join us. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.